Yes, a little machine will work there very well. This is something like the 25th of September. I don't know where time goes. And you are Mrs. Norma Hoyt, Mrs. Harry Hoyt.
Norma Hoyt.
Yep. And we've been talking about your travels around the world, but I'd like to know where you first came from.
Oh, North Dakota is my natal state. But I came up to Alaska in 1931 after I had taught 3 years in North Dakota and 3 years in Colorado. Then I came up here to teach.
And where did you go first?
Fairbanks.
Incidentally, how did you come? Did you sail from Seattle?
From Seattle, yes. I took the train across, and actually, we lived on a farm, and my father drove me to Fargo, and then I took the train to Seattle, and the SS Alaska to Valdez, and there we joined up with a taxi company that had shipped up a 7-passenger, Mr. I can't exactly remember his name, but anyway, he had shipped up a large Pierce Arrow, old-fashioned 7-passenger one. And so one of the other teachers and I got passage with him, so we went on the Richardson Highway. Got to Fairbanks on September 11th, 1931.
Well, let's not rush through this first trip. First of all, the SS Alaska, yes, I sailed on the Alaska one time in the 50s. So it was still running 20 years later.
No, this is 1931.
I know. But
The
SS Alaska was in service quite a long time.
Yes, really.
And yes, it was a beautiful ship. You didn't. You told me, I think, on the telephone that on that first trip, you had stopped at every little village on the way up. It was in the fall.
Yes, it was in the fall, and of course, people loaded salmon at some places. And I had been to Alaska once before as a tourist. I didn't mention that, I guess.
No, you're a great traveler. Tell me about your trip.
Back when I was, I guess, a freshman in college, my sister's friend had come up to Juneau to teach. And, of course, she wrote such fabulous letters home of telling about this great land of Alaska. And I thought, I certainly wish I could go up there to teach. Well, I applied, I suppose, at the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I don't remember now. Or maybe it was the state schools. And I'd had only 1 year of college. But I had my teacher certificate, the elementary teacher certificate. And when I wrote up, they said, they had too many applications for each job. They couldn't take anyone who had only 1 year of college. So as it was, I went back and taught at Nome, North Dakota for 3 years. Then I took a year off and went to school. Then I taught 3 more years in Colorado, went back to school a year. And while I was teaching in Colorado, there was a superintendent in Denver, Mr. Kepner, who organized a tour to Alaska. We paid $25 a month all year towards this tour, and then the balance of it in July. And then we came up on the Dorothy Alexander, a Canadian ship. There were 3 of us teachers from Rocky Ford, Colorado. And of course, I think the earliest impressions are the most lasting. So I still just remember so clearly our trip at Ketchikan, where we walked up the Rainbow Falls and saw the salmon spawning, because I'd never seen salmon in the in dry North Dakota. We didn't have any fish,
What did Ketchikan look like at that time?
Well, it was
a fishing village, like it is.
Yes, and what impressed me, was that the sidewalks of the first and second street were built over the water. That was most impressive. I don't know if it's that way now, or if they've pushed back.
Boardwalks
over the bay. And we went up to the falls to see the salmon. And then, of course, we stopped at Petersburg, Wrangell. And in Juneau, we were all teachers on this ship.
Did you visit any schools at that time as a part of the tour business?
No, we didn't. No, it was already vacation. Mm-hmm. But we did visit the governor's office, and of course he asked us where we were from and said, well, he was from the Midwest himself, and he shook hands with all of us. Well, I did visit one school, Sheldon Jackson College.
In Sitka.
And I still remember the very interesting and fascinating museum. Of course, at that time, I did not know that I would be returning to Alaska as a teacher, and that for 16 years, I'd be on the board of trustees of Sheldon Jackson College. So, but I had visited Sheldon Jackson College. Well, it wasn't a college then. It was a school.
That's right.
It started as a school for girls or missionary, not only missionary teachers, but or missionary teachers' children, but some of the natives who had no other place to go. I remember one lady in Sitka told me later that her parents did not want her to go to school in Sitka because that was a place for, not for the natives, but for slave girls, she said. See, they could, it happened that Mrs. McFarland, the first teacher, took in girls who had, you know, were going to be sold into white slavery. And I remember.
I haven't heard about this. I don't even know what you're talking about.
You know?
Would you allow? I know what white slavery is, but I really didn't know that such a thing was.
Oh, you should read the autobiography of S. Hall Young, where he tells quite. And then also the books on the life of Amanda McFarland, who was the one who started the first schools. There were daughters of some of the natives that were given to the white men, to, you know, which sort of like slaves. They actually, I suppose, weren't slaves, but that's what this woman said. She said, Sheldon Jackson is a place for slave girls.
In other words, I just wonder, do you know the details of this? For example, if an Indian man is going to give his daughter, which was a custom, if
yes.
they wanted to establish some sort of a trade relationship or friendly relationship with a man, be he Indian or white, they would oftentimes give a daughter.
Yes, that's true. And not only in Sitka. That happened on the Yukon. Let's see, what is the name of that? One of the explorers, he was British. His ship was frozen in the Yukon. And in Mears was his name, Colonel Mears. Or I'd have to look it up to get exactly the name, but in order to make friends with the Indians in the area, he was given a handful of beads, a hatchet, and a girl to keep him warm during the winter.
Now, by the next step, how was it possible for these girls to go to Sitka? How could they, if the father gives a girl to a man, she's pretty well bound by family tradition to stay with that man.
Yeah, but she can run away.
She can run away.
Yeah. So that's why they were called slave girls, I suppose. They ran away, and then they would run to the mission, and the mission would
protect them. Most interesting I hadn't
heard. Well, I've read that, and and then this one lady in Sitka said that her parents did not wish her to go to school because this school was not for the elite natives. But of course, Sheldon Jackson did become, first of all, the native school, and many of the children were orphans. And then they had a boarding department. They took care of even little infants. Then they had just elementary school through the eighth grade, and then they started high school. Then they dropped the elementary school as the state schools started operating.
I see.
And while I was on the board, we dropped the high school, so it's now just a two-year
college,
accredited junior college.
While you were on the board, that change took place then?
Yes, it did.
When did Sheldon Jackson pass away? Do you recall himself? Did you ever meet him?
Meet him because he was, it was 1868.
In 92 he brought this. He brought the reindeer over in the
90s.
80s and 90s, 18. He was active.
Yes, around
1900
and that.
Perhaps survived, but he didn't. I didn't know what his age was when he had started the school.
1878 is when Sheldon Jackson School was started, because they will have their centennial in four more years.
I see.
Because it was the earliest, one of the earliest schools in Alaska. Well, going back, we're still in 1931.
Yes.
After Sitka.
Well, we're still on your first trip up here.
On
the 25, you said.
1927.
27.
On this Canadian, large Canadian ship, SS Dorothy Alexander.
That was a tour ship.
Yes. One thing that was different with that one than any other ship, in our stateroom, there were three bunks, one over the other. And the three of us, Rocky Ford, Colorado teachers, had three bunks. That's the only time I've been on a ship that had triple bunks. Well, we went up to Skagway, that, of course, was very interesting. I still remember the dahlias as large as dinner plates. and the museum, and then we went on the
Let me ask you about Skagway. Of course, that was the big jumping off place for people who came up by ship in the 1898-1900
yes.
gold rush, and because the railroad terminus really was Skagway after the White Pass Railroad.
Yes, after that.
So then for quite a few years, well, Skagway remained important because of its railroad terminus position. Mm-hmm. Did it have any of the gold fever feeling still in 1927? Was there, did you sense any interest in gold in the mining activities?
I didn't see anything about mining. I think it was just tourism more, at least
Skagway at that time.
With this entire group of tourists coming.
Well, I know with the, your tourist group it would have been, but I was just wondering if around the town you sensed any of the, by 1927, that was a period of quiescence for mining in Alaska, really.
Because I think, of course, there was interest in the copper, but that would have been out of Cordova, not out of Skagway. Mm-hmm. So in Skagway, there's the Pullen House.
Yes.
And of course, that was one of the things that we went to see. And then they had their taxi was something like a fix up like a streetcar. It was a very, very different type with a horse-drawn streetcar, actually. I remember. But of course, this is so many years ago, it's hard to remember. Now, we took the train then, and it was very interesting to see, as you can see today, the path along the mountain where the Gold Horse, yes. And there's a monument to the horses that were, you know, could no longer work, and they just
killed over
and pushed them over. Terrible. Just awful. All the thousands of horses and mules that they had during the gold rush. And of course, that's a fabulous, fascinating railroad as far as the construction goes.
And how so?
Well, because it was cut out of the rocks, you know.
Blasted out of the rocks.
And
narrow gauge.
Narrow gauge, and then the bridges are so high. And many of them are wooden bridges, so it's just...
Did you go on to Whitehorse?
No, we did not. We just went as far as Lake Bennett, where we had blueberry pie.
And roast beef?
Oh, I suppose. I suppose it was a moose, maybe.
I you know, they say it varies. Let's see, it never varies. It never varies. The menu has been the same ever since they started in 1902.
Yes, I'm sure.
Roast beef or roast moose or whatever it is.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I think blueberry pie.
Yes, and they serve it family style. It's great. One of the very interesting things is when we stopped at the border, we were told that during the days, during the boundary dispute, why the flag, you know, the Americans would take the Stars and Stripes and set it over there, and the British would take their flag. So they fought over the boundary. And of course, there are several books written on the boundary dispute. Because,
and the final settlement, oh yes, that was it.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to show you my atlas that shows where the British wanted the border. And if they had had their way, why Skagway and Dyea, that area would now be in Canada. But
would have been along the shoreline and cut that inland waterway there.
Lynn Canal.
Yes, that would all have been in Canada.
That would all have been in Canada. But as one of the books said, as usual, the Americans got their way. That's a sentence I can show you in one of my books.
Oh, my.
Well, we returned back to school, back to Rocky Ford, and with my pictures and my enthusiasm for Alaska. But I thought, well, I had sort of gotten it out of my bones, out of my mind. See, I had tried to get to teach and didn't get a chance. But then out of a clear sky, 1931, by this time I had...
4 years.
I had finished school. I had my bachelor's degree in education. I had gone to the University of Chicago for training in as a critic teacher, as a student, you know, with student teachers at the Mayville State Teachers College in Mayville, North Dakota. And out of the clear blue sky, I had a chance to go to Fairbanks to teach. It was quite late. And when I had the chance to at least apply, I said to Mother, well, shouldn't I make an application? Well, it's kind of late, so you won't get it. It's too late in the year. Well, then when the telegram came that I was hired, and the only stipulation on the telegram was no smoking allowed. I wonder how many teachers that would knock out today. Well, then Mother began to cry. Well, she didn't want me to go to Alaska. I said, oh, I'll only be there 2 years and I'll come back. Well, as it
famous
was,
last
I...
words.
They were the famous last words. So I came up here then and I've really stayed here ever since.
So you came up then on the SS Alaska and then you took this limousine.
This limousine. Mm-hmm.
From Valdez over
That's
the Richardson
correct,
Trail.
Over the Richardson Highway.
How many miles a day would you make?
Well, let's see, we stopped, and we must have made it in 3 days. I remember we stopped at Paxson's, and what I recall mostly about Paxson's was that the division between the rooms was only cloth, muslin, between the walls.
Is that so?
I thought that, so you could hear.
You know, when I came up the Alaska Highway in the first time, 51 it was, we flew outside and picked up a car in Detroit and drove it back up. And it was in January, and staying over in the various lodges, it was extremely cold, and we realized that for the benefit of heat circulation, the walls were built as they were. But in many of these lodges, they weren't muslin, they were wood or something, very thin wood paneling of some kind. But they were always down from the ceiling 4 to 8 inches and up from the floor 4 to 8 inches.
Oh.
So the air could circulate through, as well as any sound down the hall. So there was a similarity there.
But
20 years later.
The very first weekend in Fairbanks, Superintendent Moore, Harry Moore was our superintendent then, and he took the new teachers in his Essex up not way up to the Yukon, but to Circle City.
And well, that's on the Yukon.
Oh, it's right on the Yukon?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. It's 165 miles up there.
Mm-hmm. And see, and the fascinating thing to me there was that you could go out swimming in the hot water.
Oh, you went to Circle Hot Springs.
Circle Hot Springs, yes, that's where it was, sure. Circle Hot Springs, not
Circle City.
City, no, I don't think we...
Circle City's on the Yukon. Circle Hot Springs is, 30, 40 miles south and in to the east, off to the east a little bit from the highway.
I have to look at my...
But it so you went out swimming in this beautiful hot spring.
Hot springs. And then we had vegetables that were grown in the garden with the hot water pipes under it. And, of course, that was something to write home about.
Yes. Yes, it's really...
And we saw caribou. Of course, I was hoping we'd see wild game, but I had no idea that we'd have entire herds of caribou crossing in front of us.
Do you remember where that was?
Well, I suppose it was up on the Eagle Summit, possibly.
Because, of course, that is where they are supposed to migrate. Eagle Summit is where they do run. I'm just wondering if that's where they can still go. But I was wondering if, by chance, they were somewhere else that year when you went there.
Well, that's a long time ago, so I don't think so. But that's where I think.
And there was a high ground.
And we were told by the superintendent that in the summer, you could go up to Eagle Summit and see the
midnight sun.
And, of course, this was already September, so...
It was getting dark at 9 o'clock or so. It was... I didn't realize the highway was that open at that time, that it was...
this was about the...
See, we call
that
the
Tenor Highway. It must have been the 17th of September or so. Mm-hmm. So that's about the time now, you know. And, of course, the road is open. I suppose it's paved now. That's one of the...
No, it isn't.
Well, it isn't.
No.
You know, one of the biggest surprises of my days in Alaska is that we have paved roads. I just never expected that we would have concrete sidewalks and paved roads. Because, see, we had only the boardwalks in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, too.
Dawson. I was over in Dawson City here in August, and I know walking down the boardwalk sidewalk there, it felt good for a change. You know, it was reminiscent of...
Yes, of...
The board sidewalks we had here in Fairbanks and Nome. And
yes.
So then you came back and you started teaching school there in Fairbanks.
I taught in Fairbanks second grade then for 3 years.
Where were you teaching school there? School?
We had only one school then. It was Maine.
Oh.
And then before Christmas, the third year that I was there, the school burned. We awakened one night and saw the flames, because we were staying at Groves's, which is on 9th and Cushman, in the same block as the school building. Mm-hmm. Well, here we awakened you could even hear the sizzling flames, and we wondered if we should evacuate our own house there at Groves's, because the flames were shooting so high. Well, there I lost we lost all our school books, mm-hmm. and I lost all the papers that I had accumulated, and the workbooks, and the I think one of the things I just really missed that I hated to lose was I had a list of all of the children that I had taught in my up to 10 years of teaching at that time.
Oh, and that was sad, yes.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because just for the sentimental value of checking back, yes, how my students had been. But I couldn't ever,
reconstruct it.
No, I don't suppose I could. Of course, maybe I could if I'd go to Rocky Ford and to Nome and see if they have, I guess there's not even a school in Nome, North Dakota now, where I began my teaching. So I lost the names and something about each of the little children that I had in my years of teaching. Well, then it didn't take very long for the school board to find places for us to teach. And my second grade and the third grade were taught in Moose Hall. If you recall, in Fairbanks, Moose Hall has one large upstairs floor that they possibly used for dancing or for...
Yes.
And they just put canvas. They separated and made two rooms up there with canvas. Can you imagine teaching, with...
Noisy.
Noisy with another teacher on the other side of the canvas. But we made out. And one of the interesting things we did that year in our school was to put on a circus. We had the downstairs for practicing. So my little second graders put on a circus. And we made an elephant, out of blankets, and two people under it, to make the legs of the elephant. And we had a wild cat in a cage. It was supposed to be the lion in the cage. We had, we had just a lot of compliments on the circus act that we, or the acts. Mm-hmm. We had the parade, and all indoors, of course.
These were the kids in costumes?
Yes, in costumes, the little second graders. So.
I'll bet they loved that.
They just loved that. And we had, with the entire downstairs in the Moose Hall to practice in, we had quite an arena for our circus. Each of the summers that I taught in Fairbanks, I spent a summer at McKinley Park.
Oh, you did? That hotel, when was that built? I thought that was built in the 30s, the big hotel that burned here.
It was not. This was before the hotel
before
was
the hotel
built.
Was there, yes.
Savage Camp is where the... where the tourists came, and that was 12 miles from the railroad. Of course, we only had one train a week. And the Mount McKinley Tourist and Transportation Company, which was Mr. Lingo, George Lingo, and
yes.
You'll recall him,
yes.
And Galen were the two who were possibly the owners of, or at least had the biggest stock in Mount McKinley Tourist and Transportation. They had old cars that they had gotten from Yellowstone, Pierce Arrows and what other big car?
Packards.
No, they didn't have a Packard. Willys, there was an old Willys Knight, and they'd meet the train then and take them out to Savage Camp, where they each had a tent. It was a wooden frame with a wooden floor and a tent top. And there'd be two cots in each room, and then there would be a stove in each of the cabins.
Now, Camp Denali today, which is in just past Park Boundary and Wonder Lake, has a similar arrangement in some of its accommodations.
Yes, I think I have been there, too. Well, Mr. Sheldon, Bobby Sheldon was the manager.
Oh, was he?
And, of course, he would make the tourists like it, and he'd tell them, well, you have running water in your tent. Just tip the tea kettle in.
Very good.
Well, that first year, there were two of us teachers that helped whenever they needed help. We didn't stay at the tourist camp. We just went out whenever this once a week when the tourists came. And I remember Thelma, the girl, she said, I'd rather go in there and give them a lecture on most any subject than to carry this soup into them. And her hands were just shaking because it was entirely foreign for us to be waitresses. But we did meet, many interesting people. One of them, Bishop Rowe, quite a few of the early church people. He was an Episcopal bishop.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. What was Bishop Rowe like?
A very kind.
What was your impression of Bishop Rowe?
Yes.
What makes it bad?
Well, I just thought he was very interesting. He and his wife are both buried in the Episcopal grounds by the church in Sitka now. But he was one of the early bishops of the Episcopal Church. And we met one of the Roosevelts had been up there. Was it Kermit? I don't recall. But there would be oftentimes noted, you know, either explorers or personal, you know, the very first time we were there, or that we on the actually on the very train that took us to McKinley Park that first day, the Leake and Lindley party was there that had scaled Mount McKinley in 1932.
Yes.
Leake, Lindley, and Grant Pearson, and Taylor, and one
I,
other.
You don't mean Ike, no, Ike Taylor no, was the road.
No, he was the road commission.
Yes.
But so we met, you know, those personages.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's worthy of comment that people who live in Alaska have a certain cosmopolitan quality because they have an opportunity to meet and know people who are noted people of achievement.
Yes.
Because they come here.
Yes,
and Alaskans
true.
Get acquainted with them.
That's true.
And share in the quality of those people who have achieved international renown
yes.
in some field. And it kind of rubs off on the Alaskan. I noticed this when I came up here 30 years ago.
Yes,
as when you're lost in the milieu of Los Angeles or some other urban area, you don't have the opportunity to know intimately men Lindbergh or whoever, the same sort of thing.
Well, what if I should write for the Reader's Digest a story on the most unforgettable character I've met, I would say it was Maurice Marino. He was a white-haired Italian who ran the Marino Roadhouse at McKinley Park, a stately man who had been in the service of Italy and had been in Africa during the Belgian Congo or someplace where there had been troubles. And then he had come up to Alaska, and here he had started this roadhouse. And it was a big sprawling building made of logs. Well, the very first day that Thelma and I were there, we said we'd go and see if there was any mail for Mr. McFarland, the people with whom we were staying. And we didn't exactly know which door to use because this was such a place with many, many doors. But we went to the door that was closest to the railroad track. We rapped and rapped and rapped, and finally Morris came and opened. And we said, oh, did we come to the wrong door? And he bowed in the most stately fashion. And he said, all our doors are open to you, as are our hearts. I've never forgotten that.
How dramatic.
Romantic.
Romantic, absolutely.
Yeah. And he would sing Italian arias, you know. Oh, he would sing all day. He'd always wore his hat on top of his white head and a red bandana as he fixed breakfasts or whatever, because he had the roadhouse there.
Where was that roadhouse located?
You know, it's entirely gone now. You can't even see the place it was. But it was near the railroad track and towards Riley Creek. From the front of it, you could look down and see Riley Creek.
I see.
And you could see that long railroad bridge.
Put a big campground up there now.
Yes, they do.
Yes, that's where the campground
but there isn't even... I was in McKinley Park this summer. You couldn't even see a sign of where the...
And it was a big two-story.
Yes, it was. And a log. And it had a front porch and a back porch. And it had, you know, several rooms and... was just very, very
and
wonderful.
So did people off the train stay over there?
There's some of them, you know, that were possibly looking for work or some,
mm-hmm.
but not the tourists. We stayed there at one time. But he had such strange way of charging. If you, at that time, soup was 15 cents a can. And if you bought one can of camel soup, why, it was 15 cents. But you, three of them, you had to pay 50 cents. He said if you could afford to buy three cans, you could pay the extra nickel for free. So, you
how
know.
How about that? As a matter of fact, this is Alaskan logic.
Is it?
Yes.
Yeah. The soup is 15 cents for one can, but three for 50 cents. And other prices, candy bars, you paid more when you bought several.
Mm-hmm. How about that?
Well, he was a very interesting character. He's now lies buried up on the hillside overlooking his...
Did he ever tell you why he had come to Alaska? What had brought him up here?
Well, I don't recall. I just imagine that because we visited quite a bit with him because I spent 4 summers in McKinley Park. And he was just a very wonderful character. And
no wife?
No, he had not married.
I'll be darned. But had he just sought his fortune?
He had been into the mining area too, but did not make a go of mining, or possibly chose rather to have this roadhouse built and cook for anyone who did wish to come. And he had several, you know, bedrooms that he mm-hmm. could rent out if the need a rose.
What a colorful person.
Oh, he was just fantastic.
I can hear this Italian aria going off into the air.
Oh, beautiful. He would just sing. He just, operas, one after the other. Italian operas. Beautiful voice. So he's the most remarkable character.
Most interesting. So did you go in through the park? Was the road built in then to Wonder Lake?
No, the road wasn't built that far. One of the interesting experiences we had the very first year when Thelma Hunt was with me, again one of the teachers, and we had met Red Brown, who had a mine at Copper Mountain. And he had come, Red Grant, I mean his name was Red Grant, I don't know if you've ran into him or not. He was an old timer. And he had said that we should come and visit him. And also in Fairbanks during the school year, we had met Nellie, no, what was her name anyway? Isn't it terrible that I don't remember it offhand? Joe and, it wasn't Ella. Boy, I'll have to come back to it when I think about it. Well, anyway, she said we should come out to her home. They lived out in the Kuskokwim, Kantishna area, the Kantishna. What was her name anyway? She was called the Witch of Denali.
Oh, I don't know about her. No, I don't know
yes,
about her.
Yes, everybody should know about her. There's a whole chapter in Mary Lee Davis's book about her, and I know it as well as I know my own name, but right now it has skipped me. Well, anyway, she had said we should come and visit her. So we made arrangements. We got Harry Hoyt to take us as far as the road went.
Oh, where did you meet Harry Hoyt?
Well, see, he was the master mechanic for the road commission.
In Fairbanks?
In the area from Anchorage up to McKinley Park, in all the area there.
Yes.
And so he was going out that way, and so we bummed a ride in his truck. And then the people at the park explained to us how we could cross the river. See, there was no bridge on the East Fork of the McKinley. And in order to go to Fanny Quigley, there I got
That's
the
it,
name.
Fanny Quigley.
Oh, the terrible
yes,
I can remember.
Yes.
Yes, Fanny Quigley. See, Fanny Quigley had come to Fairbanks, and someone asked her to talk to some of the children at school. Well, she went to only one room, and when they found out how she swore and what language she used, they did not
they
let her go.
They discouraged her.
But she just wanted us to come and visit. We said, oh, we'd be glad to come and visit. So Thelma and I planned to visit Fanny Quigley. And we had been told that we could walk across this East Fork of the McKinley if we'd be careful. You could see where there are riffles, and that would be the place where there would be rocks under, and you could step carefully. So as I said, Harry took us as far as the edge of the river, and then Thelma, who was taller than I and had heavier boots, would get a footing on one rock, and then she'd reach back and take my hand, and we crossed that East Fork of the McKinley, which must be at least a third of a mile across. Well, then we got up to Red Grant's cabin, wet, you know, from having waded across the river, and splashed on our knickers as we wore then. So right away,
you were wearing your skirts were mid calf, or so.
No, we had knickers. We called them knickers. We didn't. We had the tight fitting trousers.
Oh, you did.
What were those called? Jodhpurs.
Jodhpurs.
Something
yes,
like
indeed,
that.
Yes, indeed, absolutely.
Yeah. Because knickers. I did have some knickers, and that's that comes into the story a little later. Well, anyway, we Red Grant found overalls for us so that he could hang up our clothes and over the stove so they could dry. And then we were going to go out the next day and start for Fanny Quigley's. And that would be about a 20-mile walk.
Oh, wow.
And, but that evening, the...
I just want to make sure everything's all right. I thought something occurred to me, a disaster, if we shouldn't...
Well, there was a disaster that evening when John Romar, one of the rangers, came over to Red Grant's and said, we've had a telephone call from the superintendent, Harry Leek, that you're not to go out. We don't have time to hunt for your bones, and there are bears around the highway. Well, then Thelma said, well, then we're not going. This message from the superintendent had said that George Lingo and Mr. and Mrs. Dixon were coming, and we could go behind their teams or their pack horses. And he would send them a day early so that we wouldn't have to wait more than an extra day. Well, Thelma said, we're not going to go. We're not going to tag behind team, or this year, Mr. Dixon was a park naturalist, and he was in the park to get specimens of, you know, bird life and rodents and the like that for the National Park Service. Well, Thelma said, we're not going to do that. And so we fought until 3 o'clock in the morning, and she got sleepy and fell asleep. And I had my way. We are going to stay. So that next day, Red Grant said we could go mining with him. So he took us into his mine, and we found quite a few pieces that he told us, you know, that was gold. And actually, it was chalcopyrite, you know, which looks like gold.
But fool's gold.
Yeah, fool's gold. And we filled our pockets with fool's gold and waited then, had to wait the next day. And then by this time, George Lingo had come with the four horses, and Mr. and Mrs. Dixon, or the three of them, each had a horse to ride. Well, they told us that we had better start out ahead of them. In fact, some of George's horses ran away during the night, so he had to round them up before they could start. And these horses were to be pack horses. They had no packs on yet, but they were going to stop at the first road commission camp and get their packs put on that they were to haul. Well, Thelma and I started out in ahead of this party, and of course the first thing we had to do was cross the this river and get all wet again, but in walking we sort of dried out. And then very soon George came galloping towards us. See, we had started out at least an hour ahead of them, and he said, Mrs. I said to the horse that Mrs. Dixon is riding, you know, is so small, she's never been on a horse, she's just getting so sore from riding, so you girls will have to take turns walking with her, and then the other one riding. So that was fine. We by this time, I think we had gotten up to the road commission camp, and they loaded the packs on the four horses.
How interesting.
And we started out. See, then there were the three riding and two of us walking and four horses with loads. Well, this went on. I had my turn at riding, and then Thelma had her turn, then it was my turn again. And
because Mrs. Dixon didn't want to ride
anymore. Yeah, she didn't want to ride anymore, because she was a very, very heavy woman.
I see.
And had never having been on a horse.
Yeah.
Okay. She said she'd rather walk, and then she wanted, and we thought, well, one of us could just as well use her horse. Well, it was my turn to ride when, and we were, and George Lingo came riding towards me, and he said, will you get off and let Thelma have your horse, and you help me, and we'll go ahead and make camp, because these horses are trying to rub off their packs. We had come into timber by this time.
Yes.
And
to go faster and lead the horses faster to get rid of their packs.
Yes, and see, then if we could go ahead to camp, to the ranger station where we were going to stay.
Yes.
And then the slow people could
walk along and
I'll never forget how, because I felt
exactly.
I'm trying
to think where you are at this point in the park. I'm trying to visualize it.
Well, we're way up into the park. We're almost at, where Camp Eielson is now.
Yes.
See, it was, it's along that river, and it's along Muldrow Glacier, because we were on the Glacier Moraine much of the time.
Oh, I see. Yeah. You went through the valley along there.
Yes, and then up along. And, we'd gone off, I suppose, 20 miles over the tundra.
Yes.
And these clodhoppers that we used to call.
Yes.
That we don't call things
yes.
like that now. Well, anyway.
Tussocks.
Yes.
Clambering over the tussocks.
That's a good name for it.
Noah Wayne, courtesy of Noah Wayne.
Oh, good. Well, I'll never forget how I certainly must have taken the part of the Indian squaw, because I was walking behind chasing these four horses to keep them from rubbing against the timber, and George Lingo in his white steed rode ahead, you know, like the medicine man.
Yes, yes.
And then we got to our destination then, quite a ways ahead of the others, so we got the packs off the horses, and then we built the fire and got our beans ready for the dinner, and then we decided that of course, we were going to stay there overnight, and then Thelma and I were going to walk on. Well, Mrs. Dixon had the bright idea. She said, I would rather rest a day. She says, George, if you'll take these two ladies, or these two girls, or these two stupid people, maybe, whatever she thought about us, said, if you'll take them up to Fanny Quigley, you can have the horses tomorrow. I said, and Joe and I will rest for the day. Well, that was marvelous. So the next morning, I had the little bay that she had ridden, and Thelma had her horse. Had Joe Dixon's horse, and George had his own white steed. And we came up to the cabin of John Boucher.
Yes.
If you remember him, he was a colorful character. We visited him. And then we had to cross the Moose Creek, I think it was. But the water there was a swift. It went up right up to the horse's belly. I don't know how we...
You couldn't have made it across
the river. Well, we could, because there was an aerial cart that you could get into, and you'd pull your way across the
river. Yes.
And then as we approached Fanny Quigley's, here came Fanny out. She'd had her spyglasses or her, you know, binoculars out to see who in the world was coming, these three people on horses. And the very first thing she said to me was, "Norma, that's not the type of pants to wear. You should wear knickers like mine, because those jodhpurs, hurt the circulation of your legs." So that's the first way, her greeting to me. Well, we dismounted, and she fixed lunch for us. We had bear meat, and of course she kept on telling interesting tales. And she said, "Now, if you use sugar in your coffee, you stir it up well, because that sugar was carried all the way up into the cantina, and we can't leave it, you know, half of it not dissolved in your coffee."
More of course, I didn't use
her. Yes, that was fine. And she told us that the last visitor had left some sugar, you know.
In the bottom of his cup.
Of course, I didn't use sugar, so that didn't affect me anyway.
Yes.
And then both Joe...
My scotch, that's interesting, because my scotch instincts always recoil when I see a tablespoon or two of sugar in somebody's
left in the cup, yes. And now with the sugar up as high, prices, you better stir it.
But that had come all packed in.
It had been packed in during the... Mm-hmm. And then they took us to their mine shaft where they kept their vegetables. They had a beautiful garden. I took a picture of their garden. Of course, it wasn't producing right then, but they had turnips and cabbage from the year before, and they kept it in a tunnel, an entrance to their mine. That was just...
Oh, I didn't know they would keep, the vegetables would keep like that.
Yeah, well, see, nowadays we get get apples and vegetables that have been kept almost the whole year, but now they have such... scientific way of keeping the air and the circulation and everything just right, so that the fruit and the produce keeps. But this must have been just the right...
Kind of a tunnel back in
It was a tunnel in the mountain where they kept their produce.
I see.
So that was one of the fascinating experiences.
Well, that is a fascinating experience. Tell me a little bit. Now, of course,
Fanny Quigley.
Fanny Quigley has been written up.
Yes, in Mary Lee Davis. She's called the Witch of Denali. There are so many fabulous things that she had done throughout the year she lived there. Her husband was in an airplane accident one time and had a terrific cut on his nose, and she sewed it up. She sewed up so he always had a scar on his nose. Well, the last time I was in the cantina, you could hardly see the place, just all in ruin. The Quigleys are gone, and you know, the cabins just deteriorate into the ground,
yes.
or maybe somebody used the wood for campfires or something. There was just a very trace of the bench where the Quigleys lived.
Is that so? Mm-hmm. All gone. Isn't that amazing how it disappears?
Yes.
People carry the stuff off and...
Yes, that's true too. And then finally the wood returns to the earth, I guess.
Yes, it does.
You just see that. And well, that was... McKinley Park in 1930s.
I was trying to think of a lady I interviewed who had gone in there just recently. Oh, Cleora Bachner.
Oh, really?
You
she's
know.
In Fairbanks.
She's in Fairbanks, yes.
Yes, at the Pioneer Home.
Yes, that's right. And she and her former husband, oh, was it Jess?
Bachner.
It was Jess, yeah, it was Jess.
See, she's Erickson now. She's Erickson now.
Right, but it was Jess, and they had an interest in a mine in... where we were just talking about.
Cantishna,
yes. Uh-huh.
And the Hoslers had a mine there, too. If you remember the Hoslers that lived on way at the end of...
End Street or something?
Yes, way up there. They had a log house. They had their Mr. and Mrs. Hosler. They would go to their mine during the summer. They had two or three boys.
There was hard rock as well as placer.
Yes.
I've never been right to the Cantishna country.
Cantishna.
No, my dad got out there before Johnny Boucher died in 49 and 50. My dad went in there to see about a road, putting in something. He was so thrilled to have met him because, of course, we came up in 49. And Boucher was one of the last of the
Pioneer miners, I believe so.
And it thrilled my dad to have visited with him and heard some of his stories.
Yes. Yeah. So it is fascinating to hear. I think...
That was a wonderful experience to have that.
We sent lunches out, going back to the camp, and, you know, Savage Camp, and the tourists. Yeah. These tourists came and paid $25 a day, which I thought was just big.
Like $100 at least a day.
Yes, because there they had the, that covered all of their expenses. Their ride into Savage Camp, the 12 miles, and then they would go out past Polychrome Pass, and sometimes I would go with them.
Oh.
And then some of the tourists would be so frightened at Polychrome Pass, where it dips down
so
steep.
It's a high road.
And some of them refused to ride there. They wished to walk.
I wanted to walk at times myself.
Yes. So I would get out and walk with
them.
Yeah, walk with
them.
Yeah,
well,
with
how
them,
nice.
Because that was part of my duty.
Well, that was.
Yes.
Now, who was your employer, technically?
Well, it was George Lingo and Jim Galen and Bobby Sheldon. Those were the three.
Those were the three men
who ran
tourist service, the bus.
And then Lena Howard, I don't know if you know her. She and John Howard was the one who was the wrangler with the horses. I didn't mention that you could ride horseback, you know, the morning before your train left, if you wished. There were horses to ride. And they had two stagecoaches that had been shipped up from Yellowstone. So they harnessed the horses. And anyone who wished could have a stagecoach ride around the yard, you know, around the area there. So John Howard was the horse wrangler.
I see. Oh, that fits in some things that I've heard that didn't make sense.
Oh.
The stagecoach didn't take anybody out to Polychrome Pass.
No.
But it was a...
It was a like trip.
Just around the yard.
Yes. It was these old buses. Old. Pierce Arrow and old cars.
Of course, they weren't old at that time.
Well, they were secondhand.
Well, that's right. They'd come up from a
Yellowstone. And I think they got some from Pikes Peak that had... You know, going up the Pikes Peak.
Touring cars of the early 20s.
They were yellow and orange, and they were touring cars.
That's how my mother met my father. My grandfather bought a touring car. He was a San Francisco businessman, and he bought this touring car, and my grandmother and mother and girlfriend and aunt and uncle set off north, and my father was a civil engineer.
Oh, really?
In Northern California, and the car broke down, and so they had to camp at Mount Shasta.
Really?
And so they had walked into the little town of Dunsmuir one day and were walking back toward where they were camped up on the river in a campground north of Dunsmuir. And my father came along and offered them a ride, and my mother and my aunt. And so they became acquainted, and then they went on up. Finally, when they got their axle set up from San Francisco,
yes.
Then they went on up to Medford, met my father's parents, and the courtship continued on.
But
it was a touring car. And that would have been... about 1920, that the touring cars, touring became popular, because mother was a young
Yes, because we had, my father had the first car in the county, and he had a car in 1904, the one-cylinder Cadillac, and then, so he had one car after the other, and of course, the roads in North Dakota were just ruts with grass between the two ruts,
yes,
you know, where the wheels were.
Yes.
And a few years later, I think we had a Buick at the time that, and Mother drove it. And she'd go to Lay's Aid and to church. And their remarks, some people said, how stupid for a man to let his wife drive, you know, the car. And some people will say, how stupid to let for a man to risk his wife's life by letting her drive one of these horseless carriages. But I remember Mother taking us to club or and going through these ruts with the grass up in the middle. The drive, there would be a chain drive on these, and that would come off. So Mother had to, you know how to get that chain back on these old
Did
cars.
You have to get under the car then to put the chain
just to
back
put the
on.
Chain back on.
Well, that's funny. I can just see them with their long skirts at that time.
Yes. And the wide hat with the veil.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And
right under the chin.
What I thought was fascinating about the old cars was you could look in the mirror or in the headlight and you'd be upside down, you know. You're too young to know about this.
No, I'm not. I'd forgotten that. Oh, no.
Old carbide lights.
It goes back to my pretty early childhood, but I do remember that.
You'd look in this big headlight.
Right. With the mirror up, the image with the reflective image was upside down.
You were upside down.
That's right. Isn't that fun?
Yes. Yeah. That dates me.
This is a period that you know that I think in making these tapes, these are things that make history, the events of history, come to life, because you know you don't write that sort of stuff down.
No, you just happen to think about it when you're talking about it.
Sure.
That's,
Well, golly, we'll go on. And but you had really some wonderful experiences. What's his name? The chap, he's now in Fairbanks. Well, at least he was in Fairbanks the other day. One of the men that you said had this operation, Don or Sheldon, Bobby Sheldon.
Oh yeah, Bobby Sheldon.
I wanted to interview him, and he declined.
Well, now that's not Don Sheldon from Talkeetna.
No.
This is Bobby Sheldon, yeah. Who was the postmaster after that.
That's right. And he was declined because of a certain amount of bitterness over the, because someone said to him, you must tell her about having the Mount McKinley Park bus route. And it aroused a bitter memory in him that he had lost the route through some sort of political activity.
Yes.
And he told me a little bit about the story, just implied, you know, through politics. He lost his business there. And he was bitter, and he didn't want to make a tape recorder.
He didn't want to make a tape recorder of it.
Not at that time. He deferred and kept deferring.
I don't think it was a going proposition, you know, with just one train a week, you know, one group of tourists. Many of them had gone the Golden Belt Tour. They got off and went up the Richardson Highway to Fairbanks and then came, and then went on the Nenana River. They took a river tour and then got on the boat, on the train, Fairbanks, and came to McKinley Park. So it was it was called a Golden Belt Tour.
Oh, how lovely that. That would have been a lovely trip.
Yes. I don't think they do that anymore, have the combination. Well, I know they don't have the river tour, but they had the, they came up on the ship and then they would get the ship again when they got to Seward.
They take the Richardson Highway up to where it probably, down the trail to where it crossed the Nenana and take a boat down where it crossed the Tanana River and then take it down to the Nenana.
Yes, that's the way many of the tourists came. Well,
so you went from there, you continued to teach then till 1934 in Fairbanks.
Yes, I did. I taught until 1934. I was married then in the fall of 1934 and to Harry Hoyt.
Who was the master mechanic over the road commission.
And then we lived in Anchorage then most.
So at 34, then you moved here to Anchorage.
And we moved to Anchorage in the fall of 34. And actually, I did go back to the park in 1935 for part of the summer, because Harry was up in that area. And Harry would be sent to all of the places where they were having road construction. And then, of course, in 1935, the colonists came. And then there was the problem of building a road to Palmer. See, there had been no road to Palmer. And then all the activity of the road commission moved into this district. And when the road was finished as far as Knick River Bridge, there was a ferry or a boat or something to do. Not a ferry, because it wasn't a real ferry. It was a boat to take them across until winter and when they...
Well, it would have to be. I guess you could call it a ferry.
Well, yes, maybe it would be.
One of those things that the current pushed.
I don't remember, because I never did see it. But Harry was always, he was working as a mechanic and that first year when the colonists had come. So pretty soon we had that dusty road to Fairbanks.
Finally pushed through.
Yes, yes. And I didn't suppose we'd ever have it paved. But then 1939 and 40, when the servicemen came, it didn't take
paved.
Very long until they started putting asphalt on it.
That road wasn't paved until 1950 or after.
Oh, wasn't it paved until then?
No, because when my dad came in 49, we laughed that the only pavement in his district.
Yes.
See, my dad was assistant to Bill Neamey. He was the assistant district engineer. Uh-huh. It was Bill Neamey was the district engineer, and he had two assistants, Larry Hatchett, my dad. And in 49, when we came, we said the only road that was paved in his district was the mile in front of the post office, mile and a half in front of the post office. No, it was a mile.
A block, you must mean.
Well, it was in front of the post office. Yes, uh-huh. And then they extended it to a half a mile. But in 49, uh-huh. It was that 49. Stretch of road in front of the post office. And as a matter of fact, there was some pavement on Elmendorf. But there wasn't much pavement here. And that road didn't get paved. They began paving it. See, that was 49. They began paving it during my dad's
time.
Yes, uh-huh. Uh-huh. Term with the road commission. Yeah. Because one of his big problems was that they had this thing that they've still really not solved. They're still in the North Slope area where the oils development is.
Yes.
They on the South Slope, of the Brooks Range. There are areas on this north road that they are still scraping off the top. Oh. And the idiots say, well, it's on the south slope of the Brooks Range. There's no permafrost here. And these are, you know, Texas engineers or wherever yes. they've come from. They scrape off. They say, up on the Arctic slope. I mean, this is one of the things that here we are in 1975, 74, that they still don't learn. The numbskulls say, well, the permafrost is on the north slope, north of the Brooks Range. Mm-hmm. And up there, we don't scrape the surface off. We put several feet of gravel down on top to make the road.
Yes.
But on the south slope, they have proceeded in certain areas to scrape the top off, expose the permafrost, and then they place their gravel over, and it's doing just what it did here. It sinks down and down and down. And during my dad's time, he found, he did quite a bit of study on the permafrost problem, and found that you don't touch the surface. If possible, you can put a layer of some insulating substance, and then you pile layer upon layer of what is a top grade, or create a grade.
Grade of sand or of gravel?
Of gravel, over which then you place your asphalt, because the black asphalt absorbs the heat,
yeah.
and this is transmitted down 4 or 5 feet.
Honest.
And if it hits that surface, then it goes into the permafrost, the frost, and warms it and thaws it, and then you get subsidence or sinking.
Yes.
And would. Then your road just continues to sink, because sometimes the permafrost is 2,000 feet thick, and your road just goes right straight to Kingdom Come. As soon as it begins to get warm, it melts, and it compacts, and it'll just go forever.
Just like some of the Alaska Highway roads.
That's right. That's right.
The poles that they have put across.
And permafrost extends, I don't know how far south, but it certainly is in throughout this area.
Well, yes. In one of the, there's an atlas that was made by some environmental group of the University of Alaska, and it shows permafrost areas, you know. And they're all over Alaska.
They're all over, and they're not something that you can really, I don't think it could be mapped so much as you have islands of areas where you will have a real healthy tree. And you'll know that for some reason, maybe an ancient glaciers followed by stream that maintained warm, dry ground, moving ground that didn't have a chance to refreeze. You've got an area that maybe an island of a few hundred feet or a few miles free of permafrost, and then you've got the vast frozen ground around it.
It's real interesting. I saw an interesting film on what they have done for permafrost in Russia. One of our people from here went to Russia for a 6-week study, you know, and on permafrost, and he brought back quite a few pictures.